Welcome to the Materials Inside Special Edition podcast in celebration of Pride Month. Over the course of this mini-series, we've invited guests from the LGBTQI+ community to talk to us about their experiences and opinions on a range of both interesting and often sensitive subjects. Throughout the series, we will be supporting Black Beetle Health, a charity which is intentional about their fight against racism, stigma, and misinformation which negatively affect the health outcomes and experiences of LGBTQI+ Black and people of colour. Goodfellow is a UK materials company based in Huntingdon. However, this month, we are taking a step back from materials to fully embrace and celebrate Pride. While these podcasts solely represent the views of the guests involved, Goodfellow fully support their staff and customers who identify as part of the LGBTQI+ community. Throughout Pride Month, we'll be talking about LGBTQ+ art, sports, hobbies, health and community.
This week, we are taking a look at sports and hobbies. I'm joined by two guests who run clubs for the LGBTQI+ community. We are talking about why clubs and groups which cater for the community are so important. Peter Barnes joins me later to talk about some LGBTQI+ sports and hobby groups which are available in Manchester and why we need them. But first, Jonathan Hump joins me to talk about LGBTQI+ rugby club he helps to organise, the Unicorns. Jonathan also works within the science and medical fields as an immunologist in tropical diseases. Hello, Jonathan.
Morning, thank you very much for having me.
Tell us a little bit more about how you got into science.
Well, it all started sort of when I was, you know, younger, and I was kind of obsessed with medical TV programs and things like Casualty and all this sort of stuff. And then I sort of transitioned as I got older into doing biochemistry as an undergraduate. I sort of took a step away from the medical route. And then after I'd finished my undergraduate, I knew that I was really interested in pursuing further research. And the next sort of logical step there was for me to complete my PhD. So I went off and did my PhD at the University of York. And then after having done that for 4 years, the sort of, again, next logical step for me was to continue researching. By that point, I was kind of hooked by it and was really interested to see what was out there. And then I ended up at the University of Oxford as a postdoctoral researcher. And that's where I am at the minute.
And talking about your career now, what are you doing? Tell us a little bit more about your professional projects.
So currently I kind of have two different projects that I work on. My predominant one is sort of looking at the intersection of genetics and inflammation, which can sound sort of a bit intimidating, but I'm looking at inflammatory bowel disease, which has a very large sort of genetic component. We know that there are sort of genes that that sometimes don't, in patients who have IBD, don't behave the way we would expect them to due to mutations. And so we are investigating, or the project I'm working on is investigating how some of these genes are behaving, you know, what the proteins that they make, what do they do in context of the immune response. And that sort of project is hoping to sort of contribute to the knowledge base on inflammatory bowel disease and hopefully potentially inform therapeutic investigations in the future. And the other project, which kind of came about actually because of, you know, COVID, because of the pandemic, when everyone shut down, I couldn't go to the lab. And as a lab researcher, that sort of curtailed my projects a little bit. So me and my boss at work, he had a project that he very kindly got me to start working on, which was looking at how changes in what changes do we see or can be measured in the microbial environment of the gut, what's called the microbiome, in IBD patients between different sampling methods. So, you know, there's different ways of collecting samples from the GI tract from analysis, and we're investigating how do they impact the sort of microbial composition.
This podcast, of course, is all based on LGBT community. And as an academic, do you think there's LGBT representation and visibility?
In terms of academia as a whole, obviously, that's quite difficult because every university is its own sort of microcosm. It's not necessarily the same as a private company that has lots of offices spread around that can set sort of centralized policy. Each university does its own, has its own take and its own policies, as far as I'm aware. I'm not an expert on that. I think there's definitely inclusion in academia. When I first started working at Oxford, for instance, there was, you know, the induction pack, and in that was, you know, references to the university's LGBT group for staff. And I think at an undergraduate level, you have all of the societies available, you know, the LGBT societies. And so I do feel sort of that there's inclusion. I mean, maybe some things that can be worked on are sort of visibility is maybe a different thing. How visible are LGBT scientists? Are we out there? Can we be seen? And I don't know that that's fully sort of, for me, I would say I don't know many out senior LGBT scientists. And so maybe visibility is a key thing that can sort of be driven going forward.
Throughout this podcast, this special edition, we're going to ask the same question to all our guests. Of course, in your opinion, what does Pride mean to you?
Okay, that's a sort of far-reaching question, I guess. I think pride for me is about sort of almost, I guess it's kind of a strange way of saying it, but almost achieving a sort of us getting ourselves to a place where we don't really need pride anymore. It's about, you know, showing LGBT people that, you know, that we exist, that we just want the same things as everybody else. We want to have normal, happy, healthy lives. And I think for me, it's being proud of who you are and what you've overcome to get to where you've been, and a celebration of our community. We are a diverse community made up of many different people, all with amazing, you know, backstories and amazing accomplishments. So I think it's sort of an entanglement of all of those things, you know, celebration, progression, and that's what it means to me.
Thank you very much. That's a great message. Going back to your career, what would you describe as your proudest professional achievement?
It's a, sort of the cross between a professional and educational moment. But for me, I think it would be my PhD viva, because I think I just remember, and you know, if other academics listen to the podcast, and it may be different for them, but I remember being absolutely terrified of my viva. I was convinced I was going to fail my PhD viva, sort of the final interview they do, and no one could convince me otherwise. And I had so much support from my supervisors at the time and my colleagues. You know, no one could encourage me otherwise that I would be fine. And I came out and I was absolutely fine. And I just remember having this moment of sitting on a bench outside the building, and just, I was kind of like this. Just relief just flooded over me that I was like, oh my god, this is it. You know, something I've been working on for the last 4 years, and it's come to fruition. And I think, you know, if there's any PhD students or potential PhDs listening as well, they'll probably empathise with that horrible sort of build up to your viva, and really, you know, the nervousness and the anxiousness. But it is genuinely okay in the end. You know, it always does work out. You've worked hard for 4 years, and it shows it in your interview, in your viva, and that for me was a big thing, just to get through that and have passed, and it was very good for me.
It's interesting. Your PhD is of course a reason for you to be very proud. I'm sure of that. You also told me before you had some interesting areas while at university. Can you tell us a little bit more about your studies?
With regards to my PhD, I was investigating a tropical parasite called Leishmania donovani. And leishmaniasis itself is what's called a neglected tropical disease. So it tends to affect countries, well, the name comes from, as far as I'm aware, around the tropics, but it affects countries like Sudan, India, Brazil. And it was a sort of interesting thing to study, because it's not a heavily Western disease, and there's not a lot of money in R&D for new therapeutics. compared to other diseases such as tuberculosis or malaria. And it, you know, from when I was last reading papers on it, Leishmania donovani, or what's called which causes a disease called visceral leishmaniasis, kills about 20,000 people a year. So it was a sort of interesting thing to study that, quite sad at the same time. But I was very interested in my research sort of took mathematical modeling, pharmacology, immunology, and I was investigating drug distributions in the body to see if we could optimize therapeutic regimes for the treatment of L. donovani.
Really interesting. Your main research is based on a disease that does not affect the Western world. So you already mentioned that you got interesting in that, but why did you decide to go down that route?
Well, I would say one thing when it comes to picking a PhD is I'm sure other people do it a lot better. But when you're a sort of bright-eyed and bushy-tailed undergraduate like I was, you have a rough idea of what you're interested in. I knew immunology interested me. There were other sort of biological fields of study that I found interesting too. But sometimes you just go into these situations sort of blind. So I went to York and I interviewed them. I'd never heard of leishmaniasis before my interview. I'd done a couple of modules of immunology at my university at undergraduate, and I knew I liked it. But when I really went for the PhD, it was meeting who would then be my supervisors in the lab group that kind of showed me that it was an environment to work in. So it wasn't necessarily the direct study, because I think unless you've had some sort of hands-on research experience in those fields, which I hadn't had, you don't really know what you're getting yourself in for. And so I almost fell into it by chance, basically. You know, I was lucky enough to have a group of great supervisors and an amazing lab group, and that got me into the PhD. And then through that, I developed my interest in immunology and the study of leishmaniasis.
Really interesting. We spend our previous, the first series of our podcast talking about how to inspire the new generation, and what you just said. You're still very young, I know that, but what would you say to someone that is listening to the podcast and is kind of looking for inspiration for science? How would you advise someone to do it if the same way that you have done your choice?
The inspiration, whether they're sort of just about to start an undergraduate or just about to start a master's or just about to start a PhD and they're looking around, I think there are inspirational scientists in the field. So I think something that can always help is to look around at different universities, at different labs that sort of interest you. And, you know, the one step might be to email and say, you know, hello, this is who I am. I'd love to come and to help out in the lab for 2 months. Is there a mini project or thing? You know, it's not uncommon for academics to receive emails like that. That's one way of sort of seeing. Or you can, you know, email them and asking for advice. You know, the job of an academic is also partly to help with the future researchers. You know, so it can just be as simple as of emailing them for a conversation and just saying, hi, you know, this is who I am. I'm really interested in this. What would you recommend? And I think that's a good start, is just getting your foot in the door, getting some informed advice from people who know academia very well and know the research field.
At this stage, of course, we're still going through this COVID pandemic, and there's a lot of information and misinformation around and controversial and all this. In your opinion, as a scientist, how we combat the misinformation?
I mean, I'm no expert on sort of the sources of misinformation or anything like this. I think you do see a lot of misinformation. I think there's sort of a trend sometimes with like the big news broadcasters to sort of go for the more inflammatory and explosive sort of titles and there's sort of different elements to it. I myself am not, like, for instance, on Twitter, but I know a lot of my colleagues are. And there was a sort of discussion recently, I think, in the sort of scientific sphere about, you know, you should go on Twitter. And if you're on Twitter already and you see people posting misinformation, you should seek to educate. You know, you've got to do it in the right way. You don't want to be patronizing, you don't want to be rude, but you should point them to the correct sources of information. But something that maybe I feel can sort of help is, I think scientific information really should be information for everyone. Just there's a sort of thing in the scientific publishing at the minute. Yes, we have all these paywalls, and that's a sort of different issue. But I think also at heart, scientific papers can be quite complicated things to get your head around. And if you're, you know, if you're not a scientist, it doesn't matter what your job is, but you're interested, and especially now, like COVID, a lot of people told, oh, we've got the trial information, or we've got the scientific studies. You know, some people might want to see if they can get to grips with it themselves. And I think one thing that can help with that is, you know, more sort of broken down summaries of papers and you know, pitching it in such a way, or maybe doing a, you know, a blog on it or things like this, you know, really helping access the baseline information and making that more accessible. I think it would be something that was very helpful, because then there's less of a reliance on, or it takes away the power maybe of people who manipulate that information into something scary. When an informed group has broken it down into easily understandable, you know, taking the graphs, explain what they mean and things like that, I think that it takes away that power of people who've twisted it when you have someone who's explained it in a really achievable and accessible manner.
Very interesting. Our podcast original mission is to simplify and make accessible to everyone the materials world. You already mentioned about being important to deliver the message in an easy way to everyone understand. But on the medical side and scientific way you work, how important is for us to simplify and have an understandable message for the rest of the people?
I mean, my sort of viewpoint on it, and obviously I can't speak for anyone else, is that, you know, scientific communication is key, is crucial to what we do. I think, you know, the general public are interested in science and scientific research, and they shouldn't be shut out on the basis that, you know, papers and things like this are sometimes written in ways that are very professional, and yes, if you're in that field, you'd understand it quite easily, but I don't think that should automatically exclude you from the scientific discourse. I think bringing more people into the understanding is very key. I think, again, I'm not an expert on this so much, but I think something that sort of happens in sort of pharma now is sort of patient-driven outcomes. You know, listening to the patients a lot more regarding, you know, their treatment. You know, before, you know, if they're suffering from an ailment, what's their quality of life? How is it impacting that? And I think, you know, there's lots of different ways. It's not just about communicating your results in a more simpler way. There's lots of ways that science can be attainable to a lot of people. And I think that is key that we keep driving that.
Thank you very much. Yes, we all agree that we need to simplify this type of message and open the scientific world to access easily. Outside the scientific world and your work, you also play on an inclusive rugby team. What's your involvement with them?
So I play for a rugby team called the Berkshire Unicorns. We're based out in Maidenhead. Well, I joined them just as a player a couple of years ago. I'd met them on a night out. I was really looking to get into a sport, but I was quite intimidated to sort of join the standard rugby team that was by my house, because, you know, I was, even though I'm a big guy, I'm, you know, 6'2 and 110 kilograms, I was still a bit intimidated to join. I was worried that I might be sort of excluded because I was gay, or that would impede my ability to join the team and really become one of the guys on the team, sort of thing. So I met the Unicorns on the night out, and they were so lovely and so friendly to me, and I just thought, right, I'm just going to try. And I went to training, and I loved it so much, and I've not stopped going back. And in that time, and I commute, and they are not my local team. I drive an hour each way every training session to go train with them, and I'm also now the team manager, so I have some responsibilities with organising it and running the rugby club. And yeah, that's sort of my story with them so far.
And you mentioned the way that you got in contact or got to know the Unicorns. Why do we need an inclusive rugby team?
There is an article that I wrote about this on the Berkshire RFU website about, I guess I'd say I phrased it more, a common question we get with this is, why don't you join a normal team? And you know, and that's sort of along the same lines, but differently phrased to why have inclusive rugby teams. And I think it's key to understand that there are a huge group of people out there that wants to play, you know, sport, any sport, but in this case, rugby. And there's something standing in their way, and they may be able to articulate and say exactly what that is, and they may not. For me, I wanted to play rugby. And as you know, and as some people say, it sounds silly, but I was scared to join that local team. I thought I would be excluded. I thought that I wouldn't have a good time. And members of the LGBT community have faced, you know, discrimination and sometimes threats of violence and verbal abuse, and those sort of experiences can leave you wary. And then you take that traditional image of what rugby is, and it's stereotyped, rightly or wrongly, as a sort of laddie, you know, white straight men drinking, going out, you know, smashing each other on the rugby pitch, going out and then getting drunk. Whether that stereotype is true or not, it sticks with you, and you kind of just think, oh, I don't know if I'll fit in. And whereas with the Unicorns, we're inclusive, so it's not just LGBT, we, you know, men, women, non-binary people, trans people, black Asian minority ethnic, people from black Asian minority ethnic communities. Everyone's welcome, and we have no prejudice for who you are or anything like that. Regardless of any defining characteristic, you can join our team. And that, I think, is a key driver. You know, there are some people that just don't feel comfortable. They feel like they'll be ridiculed or they feel unsafe, and we provide an environment where that's just not going to happen to them.
Thank you for that. There's a lot of conversations going on at the moment in sports with racism, and we also know that lots of concerns with the LGBT community, even from, like you said, the normal teams, not only rugby. That takes me to another question, not far away from one that I already asked about Pride, but why do we still need Pride?
I think that's, you know, another interesting question, and everyone has a different perspective on it. I would say one thing coming from me is, you know, I had somewhat conservative parents growing up with regards to sort of, you know, sexuality. I never really grew up being part of an LGBT community. I didn't really know or have any friends in an LGBT community up until I joined my rugby team. So I kind of, for a long time, never went to Pride, never really sort of indulged in Pride Month at all. You know, to me, it was just another time. But I would say now, having been, you know, kind of thrown in the deep end with a fully LGBT sort of community, and I think you have to appreciate now, you know, when I stop to think about it, there are things that I just feel like I cannot do that your sort of average heterosexual couple could do. You know, with my partner, when we walk down the street, I don't like to hold hands for fear that someone will say something or react to that. I don't like to, you know, kiss my partner in public in case of the same thing. And I think if you take, you know, the average straight couple and say to them, have you ever felt like there was anything you couldn't do, you know, like that, like holding hands, like giving each other a peck on the cheek, they would probably say no, and they'd probably never even have thought about it. And that's why I think, you know, Pride is about, you know, showing that we exist, that we're normal people, helping progress, that, you know, we just want to be treated the same way. And ideally, when we achieve, you know, as with most, you know, the lots of inclusion measures, I kind of believe when you've, you know, people say, well, why do we need Pride? Well, the good thing will be when you don't need pride, but we're not there yet. We still have lots of lots of simple things such as holding hands in the street, but you also have lots of sort of high level things going on, you know, governmental regulations and things like that are still very much in play and a focus for the LGBT issue, and they affect our lives as well. So we do need pride, and I'm hopeful that, you know, that there'll be a time when we don't, because we will have achieved the equality we're after.
One of the reasons why we decided to celebrate Pride Month with this podcast and talk about that is because, like I said, we're still far away to get exactly the same that the rest of the world. And we know that we are quite lucky here in UK because there's a lot of protection to the LGBT community, but and we know that around the world that don't happen the same way. John, do you have any exciting projects coming in the near future?
Yeah, some of my work ones at the minute. I'm just about to finish off on sort of generating this the big sample input for my project that's looking at the sort of intersection between genetics and immunology in IBD. So I'm very hopeful that that's going to produce some very interesting results, and hopefully those results will be published soon. Which will then obviously put me into the expectations I've laid out myself of how do I communicate that in the best way possible, such that the results are accessible to everyone. But yeah, that's coming soon, and that's going to be quite exciting.
And we're going to be waiting to see those results. John, thank you very much for your time today. It's a great pleasure to speak with you, and we will have other conversations, I'm sure, in the future, and we'll keep an eye on your career and your new research results.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for having me.
Black Beetle Health is a charity dedicated to promoting health, well-being and equality for LGBTQI+ Black and people of colour. Through their innovative health education and promotion methods, community events and the development of a variety of evidence-based peer-reviewed resources, Black Beetle Health aims to redefine the standard of health outcomes for these communities.
Peter Barnes set up an LGBTQI+ badminton club in Manchester, which caters for beginners and social players. He also runs an LGBTQI+ board game group, which meets weekly. He joins me now to discuss why he set up these clubs and why they are so important. Hello, Peter. Thank you very much for your time today.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So you run an LGBT+ badminton club in Manchester. Can you tell us a little bit more about the club?
So the club is called Northern Cox, and it was only founded in 2019, so it's relatively new. It's essentially a friendly social badminton club for LGBT+ people. It's a non-competitive club, so we focus more on the friendly and social play so that everyone can get involved no matter what your ability is.
And why do we need an LGBT+ badminton club?
It's a really interesting point, and it's something that people bring up quite often, and not just for badminton, but for, you know, other sports and other activities. And it's not about excluding other people, and it's always, you know, we always welcome people who identify as straight, but it's about being somewhere that you can feel comfortable and confident and not be worried about being yourself. So it's not necessarily about being somewhere just so you can hang out with other members of the LGBT+ community. It's about kind of, yeah, being somewhere that you can feel confident and safe. And if you think about, you know, professional sports people, like there's always an issue about being gay in sports. It's something that is, you know, if you go back to being at school, you know, people of the LGBT+ community have always sometimes struggle with getting into sports. So I think it's kind of providing a safe space for people to enjoy sports.
You already mentioned about is an open club or open team. Do we need to have any ability or any certain standard to be part of the club?
No, absolutely not. So Wilcox is a club that's open all abilities, but it's specifically open to people who are beginners or up to intermediate players, and specifically for social play. So we don't play competitively. We kind of focus more on kind of creating that kind of community spirit, and everyone kind of just comes to play and enjoy it and get fit and healthy. There is another LGBT club in Manchester, so it's called Gap Badminton Club. And they're also a friendly social LGBT plus badminton club, but they also focus on like league play and competitive play. So there's two options really, and there's even the option to join both and play badminton in both clubs. So they're both open to all abilities. The difference is that Gap focuses on competitive play and Northern Cox focuses on social play.
And Goodfellow recently sponsored your badminton club. What benefit will the sponsorship bring to the club?
Oh, it'll bring a significant benefit to the club, to be honest. So the sponsorship has made it so that we can provide shirts to all of our regular members without any cost to them. So we're actually giving a shirt for free to each member who signs up for the following year. And it just means that nobody's then left out. We have members from all over Manchester from different socioeconomic backgrounds, and it's part of how we run the club. So it's, you know, we don't run it for any sort of profit. We never have any sort of large balance in the bank. It's always just trying to make it so that we can provide at the kind of lowest cost possible. So the sponsorship really significantly helps with that and means that everyone can feel involved and everyone can have a shirt no matter what their financial kind of troubles may be. Everyone can still get involved.
That's great, and we're very happy to support the team. Aside from sports, are you involved in any other LGBT plus groups?
I am, yeah. I actually run a board game group. So it's based actually in my flat, but there's probably about 70 members now. So I organise sessions for us to all come and play quite regularly, like at least once a week. And again, it's open to anyone. You don't have to be LGBT plus, but the vast majority of people that come are in the community. And it provides a social space for people to come together, somewhere to be kind of relaxed and to be yourself and get to know other people that are in the LGBT plus community.
Sounds a lot of fun. And what kind of games do you play?
We've actually got over 400 board games. So it all depends on the people that come. So quite often there's like on any one session, quite a lot of people will turn up. So I think at the most I've had 17 at one time. So that kind of limits the games that you can play. And with those sorts of numbers, we'll often play kind of social interaction games. So there's games called Salem and Werewolf that people may have heard of. And you can play those games with larger numbers, and it's the games that everyone's kind of involved at the same time. We also play kind of strategy games, and also like when people come to the group that are new and may not be overly experienced with games, we have some kind of more social accessible games, things like Digxit. A lot of these games may go over people's heads because a lot of people will only have heard of Monopoly and Cluedo and things like that. But these games are similar in terms of complexity, but often much more interesting and fun for people to play. So I'd always encourage people to learn some new games and yeah, come along and get involved.
Great message. And of course, with the pandemic, the board game industry actually grew a lot, and there's lots of people getting involved in games, in board game. And how has the coronavirus pandemic affected your badminton and board game groups?
Yeah, as you can imagine, it's impacted it quite negatively, to be honest. The badminton club hasn't been able to play for over a year now. So it's been tough, and I've tried to organise activities that are within kind of the legal limits. So we've been on outdoor walks, and we've done some online Zoom meetups. And the same for the board game groups. For the last year or so, we haven't really been able to meet indoors. So we've done a lot of online gaming sessions. And during the first lockdown, I ran a online quiz every week for everyone to kind of keep in touch and get involved. Yeah, it's been tough. And as with pretty much everyone over the last year, people started to get Zoom fatigued, and you know, the interest in joining for online activities kind of dwindled. But thankfully, you know, we're coming out of it now, and things are starting to get back to normal. The board game group has started up again, and we've started playing, but just in smaller groups. Badminton's not quite got there yet, but it's not far off. It's coming, I think.
Hopefully things will open up a little bit more in the next few months. The question that we asked to all our guests throughout this special edition of the podcast focused on Pride Month is, what does Pride mean to you?
Yeah, Pride to me, it's more about kind of being visible. So a lot of people, and a lot of outsiders especially, see Pride as just a big party and lots of drinking and that's all it's about. But and that part of Pride can be fun, but that's not what it's about. It's about kind of feeling part of the community and being visible within it. You know, and one of the main aspects of Pride throughout most cities across the world is the parade. And I think that's what it's all about. It's seeing different kind of companies and organizations and groups and all the rest of it kind of being part of that parade and people seeing that. So you often get kind of, you know, big industries and companies like, you know, the NHS and the police force and things like that, that will be in lots of parades. And for anyone who's LGBTQI plus that sees that, kind of, you know, helps them to start feeling more comfortable within their own community and feeling more accepted and being part of it. So I think, yeah, for me, that's what Pride's mostly about. It's helping the people who haven't managed to come to terms with their own sexuality, seeing that there are other people out there that can live in their life openly and freely and being comfortable with it. And it helps other people to get to that point as well.
It's quite interesting you saying that way, because when you look at UK, we have that already or very close to that. So that's why the question is so important to get people idea of what does Pride mean to each one of us. And why do we still need Pride?
That's another question that I hear quite a lot, because as you said, in the UK, we're quite lucky in that we're almost there. Like we've made such great advances over the years, but we're not quite there yet. And I think most every LGBTQI plus person will be able to understand that, you know, it's as simple as walking down the street and wanting to hold hands with your partner. You kind of have to check your surroundings before you do that, because there's always a risk that there's someone that's going to be, you know, walking behind you that will disagree with that. And attacks on the LGBTQI community hasn't been completely eradicated. Like, it still happens. And as much as in other places around the world, it's much more serious, and you can, you know, you can legally be, you know, sentenced to death for being gay. And obviously in the UK, we don't have that. There is still that worry that, you know, there'll be someone around that doesn't like what you're doing. Again, it relates back to what we're talking about with badminton and board games and groups, that you have LGBTQI plus groups. It's to make you feel comfortable and be yourself. And until we get to the point where you can do whatever you want and not feel scared that you might be attacked, that's why we still need Pride.
Thank you, that's a great message. And what's next for the badminton club?
Well, as I say, it's a relatively new badminton club, especially taking into account that we've not really been able to play for the last year. So it's not a huge club just yet, but it has been growing steadily. So that's what's next. I mean, I want to make it so that, you know, every LGBT plus person in Manchester is aware of the club and knows that if they want to come and join, then they can, and that it's open to everyone. You don't have to have played badminton ever before, and we'll kind of take you through everything and teach you, and yeah, so that's what's next. I hope that more people join and get involved and start to do some exercise again now that we're coming out of lockdown.
Are there any other LGBT plus sports clubs in Manchester?
Yeah, there is. There's quite a lot, actually. And there's quite a lot that Northern Cox is closely related to. So Northern Rebound is a squash club. And it's really good fun. I go there myself. And it has the same ethos as Northern Cox. It's a friendly, social squash club that caters for all abilities. So even if you're a beginner or a really experienced player, they'll welcome you in. There's Northern Aces as well, which is a tennis club. And Northern Wave. So Northern Wave is a LGBT plus swimming club. And I think it goes back to, you know, feeling comfortable and why LGBT people often struggle getting into sports. And, you know, and with swimming, there's the worries about the changing rooms and you know, not being in very many clothing. So an LGBT plus swimming club, I think, is really important because it creates that environment where you can feel safe and feel comfortable to you know, to be yourself and get involved in the sports. And there's lots. There's a football club, a polo club, a cycling club, and there's a Manchester Front Runners is a LGBT QI plus running club. And the Village Spartans is the Manchester's rugby club. And I'm sure there are more out there as well, which I'm not aware of. And this is the thing, that there's probably a sports club for an LGBT plus club for every sport that you could imagine. And I think it's really important to have that and have all those options out there so that you can get involved and feel comfortable doing so.
Thank you very much for your time today, Peter. Hope everything goes okay for the club. And of course, we'll leave links for the social media for the badminton club and the game board club if you have one.
Yeah, thanks, Joel. Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Next week is the final episode for our Pride Month special edition series. And we'll be looking at the community. Darren Mitchum will be joining to discuss the Gay Classic Car group, his involvement in the group, and the events they run. Our final guest of the series will be Susanna Thomas. Sue joins us to talk about her swimming challenges, the sports club she's involved in, and her participation at Pride events.
To learn more about Black Beetle Health or to donate, pop over to their website at blackbeetlehealth.co.uk. And of course, make sure you follow them on social media too. All other material inside podcasts can also be found at materialshub.com/podcast. Thanks for listening.